Good morning, everybody. Thank you so much again for being here this morning. We're sure to appreciate the presence of each one. The title of my lesson is up on the screen, The Persian Empire and Its Impact on Bible History, and many of you are starting to get starting to doze off and get drowsy already. I hope that doesn't happen. I'm going to make it interesting. At least I'm going to try. And at the end of the lesson, I'm not going to simply leave you with a dull history lecture, but I hope that at the end of the lesson, what I'm going to do is give you an actual moral value that we can draw from this, something you can take home this morning that we can do to actually improve our walk with God, even based on this seemingly dry topic. But it comes from what we've been studying, the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, about the history of God's people during this challenging time. And of course, when hasn't God's people been in a challenging time? It's always challenging being one of God's people in a world, in a Genesis 3 world, where the influence of Satan is widespread and sin is ever present and problems are always there. Satan is not going to let God's people have an easy time. It is always a challenging time, and Satan will always make sure of that. However, there is hope, and that's what we're going to talk about. It's how do we get through challenging times, and with God's help, how do we endure them and stay as God's people? Because that's what God's people had to do during the time of the Persian Empire. So I want to talk about that. That orange blob you see on the map there, whoops, that's not it. That orange blob that you see on the map there is, of course, the Persian Empire, circa 500 BC. That is the area controlled by the Persians at the height of their power. You will notice that the orange blob there extends all the way down to the Middle East and into the land of Israel, even down into Egypt. This is where the Persians control them. When we open the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, this is where we find ourselves. The Persians are running things. They are in control of the greatest empire in the world, and the people of Israel are subject to them. And we talked about that in the Bible class this morning, and a key passage that came up was Nehemiah chapter 9, and verse 16, where Nehemiah points out, and let me just get back over there, and I had that marked, and it fell out of my Bible. Nehemiah chapter 9, Nehemiah points out the problem, or the Levites actually point out the problem, which is that they are, Nehemiah 9 and verse 36. And here we are servants today in the land that you gave to our fathers to eat its fruit and its bounty. Here we are servants in it. And it yields much increase to the kings you have set over us because of our sins. Also, they have dominion over our bodies and our cattle at their pleasure, and we are in great distress. The people of Israel are now under the dominion of the Persian kings. And yes, they've gotten to go back to the land of Israel, but a large amount of their produce and their taxes and everything are going back to Persia and enriching the Persians. And they're frustrated by that, but it's their own fault because that's where God's people have ended up because of their past sins. So let's talk about the timeline, a little bit of history. As I was growing up, this was probably the least understood part of Bible history in my reading of the Bible. I didn't get a lot of education about this. So I had to go back and dig. We've done a lot of that, and Vince and Ken have done that a lot. And I want to kind of bring together, tie together all the stuff that Vince and Ken have been talking about in the Bible class, put it together into one lesson, and then kind of draw you the timeline and show you what's really going on here, and summarize it and reach a conclusion that I think we can all take home and learn from. To give you a ballpark as far as the timeline, we start there in 1000 BC, a nice even round number with King David. I would like to start there because it's an even number. And King David is at the height, he and his son Solomon are at the height of Israel's power and independence. David, of course, is serving God. Everything's going great. He leaves behind instructions and materials so Solomon can build the temple. And Israel finds itself as a strong, independent nation of people. And everything is good because they're serving God. Well, that's great, but of course things fall apart during the time of Solomon. And then in the days of Rehoboam, Solomon's son, the kingdom is divided. And then you follow down some centuries later. And because of their sins, the northern part of Israel, as it was called then, the kingdom of Israel, separated from Judah. But the northern part goes into captivity around 721. And again, for all these dates that you see on my timeline, you're going to see if you open a history book and it says 722 BC, that doesn't mean I'm getting it wrong. It doesn't mean they're wrong. It just means different historians may have a year off here or a year there. Don't worry about that. Just get the main ideas and the ballpark numbers here. That's the most important thing. All these dates are a little fuzzy. They may be a year off based on which historian you read. So don't worry about that. The main point is get the main point. 721 BC, the Assyria conquers the northern kingdom of Israel. They go off pretty much not to be heard from again. But the southern kingdom of Judah endures longer. They have a few decent kings, and they're able to hang on. And they hang on until 606 BC when the Babylonians show up and they take control over the southern kingdom. Don't destroy completely, but they do start taking captives off into Babylon. They install some of who they want on the throne from the sons of David. And the kingdom hangs on until 586 BC, when after numerous rebellions and despite the advice of the prophets, the southern kingdom is then taken into captivity because they've rebelled against the Babylonian king, didn't follow his instructions, tried to declare independence. The Babylonians destroy Jerusalem, burn it down, and kill a whole bunch of them and take the rest into Babylonian captivity. So there's several deportations between 606 and then finally 586, everything's destroyed and they go into captivity. And this is the time of the prophets Ezekiel and Daniel, who are prophets in the captivity. And that's where their books fit into the timeline. We then come to, here's the point in the Bible that talks about that. 2 Chronicles 36, if you want. That's kind of the summary of how Israel goes into the Babylonian captivity. Because in verse 16, they mocked the messengers of God, despised his words, scoffed at his prophets, until the wrath of the Lord arose against his people till there was no remedy. God had finally had enough. He'd certainly given them time after time and chance after chance and opportunity after opportunity and prophet after prophet, but nothing worked. And the people simply turned against God and would not repent. He brings against them the king of the Chaldeans, and that's another name for the Babylonians, the Chaldeans. And the Babylonians come in and destroy everything, steal and destroy. In verse 20, and all those who escaped from the sword he carried away to Babylon, for they became servants to him and his sons until the rule of the kingdom of Persia. And that's where we find ourselves when we get to Ezra and Nehemiah. The Persians are going to take the kingdom over from the Babylonians. But before we get to that point, though, I want to talk about the Babylonian conquest of Judah and what the Babylonians did. And there's an important quote, and I want to summarize here. I'm not going to read every word here, but I want to summarize a little bit. And this is from Mr. Vanderspeck at the University of Amsterdam. And he summarizes it pretty well. What he talks about during this deportation, the people being carried off into Babylonian captivity, he says, the deportation of large groups of people is a policy that was pursued in the entire history of the ancient Near East, although it did not always happen on the same scale. Deportation is especially useful for founding and stabilizing an empire. Remember, the definition of an empire is a kingdom that's made up of other groups of people, multiple smaller kingdoms. And when you are a king, but you rule over multiple different ethnic groups of people, you've always got a problem, because those people always resent some no good so-and-so from some other country ruling over us. Who gave him the right to rule over? He's a Persian and we're Jews, or he's a Babylonian and we're Assyrians, or whatever it is. We're Egyptians and he's whatever. Everybody resents that when some other ethnic group is ruling over them. Makes them angry. So how do you keep all these diverse groups of people under one big tent? How do you get them all under control? Well, one way to do it, and the Babylonians and the Assyrians believed in this, was you pick them up from wherever they are, pick them up and transport them and drop them hundreds of miles away in a new place. Boom. And that, now they're confused and they don't know where they are. And they have to serve you because they're not in their homeland anymore. And they depend on you to organize their country and get them settled and everything. So that may tend to disperse them and calm them down and at least keep them under better control. And so the Assyrians and the Babylonians believed that was the best way to control an empire. And to some extent it worked. And what Mr. Vanderspeck says is that that stability that they achieved, the Assyrians and the Babylonians achieved that way, when the Persians then come and take over the Babylonian Empire, they take over this kingdom that has all these people that have been moved from other places and that are now scattered, but they were moved by groups, picked up, moved, and dropped. And now you have this group of people, ethnic people, that are in this new location, but they're still clumped together. So that's what happens with the Jews. The Jews come from Jerusalem, Judah. They're picked up, moved, and dropped in the Babylonian kingdom, and they're still together. They don't all get scattered and one person here and one person there. They stay in their group. And so this is what, by the providence of God, allows the Jewish people to maintain their Jewish identity. They stay together. They meet together. And they're able to maintain their identity and not simply disappear and vanish from history and intermarry and mingle and disappear into the flow of history. The Babylonian kings deported their subjects even while keeping their urban organization intact. Cities, groups of people moved and stayed together. The Jews in Babylonia could keep and record their traditions. Okay, is that important? Of course it is. That's how they keep track of the law of Moses. That's how they keep track of their genealogies. They keep their Jewish identity when they go into captivity. After that, repatriation was comparatively easy. What do? You pick up and you go back and you move back, if you're so inclined. This policy did not shock the people involved deeply. Many people preferred to stay in their new countries. The Jewish community of Babylonia still existed in modern Iraq until recently. 2,500 years later, there were still descendants of those Jewish people still living in modern-day Iraq that had been brought there in 586 BC by Nebuchadnezzar. still living there 2,500 years later, their descendants and descendants and descendants still there. So that's the point, is this process of deportation and relocation is very important providentially in God's organization of how he wanted things to work out. And these kings practice this. While they're in captivity, Daniel, of course, the young teenager, or as far as we can tell, gets taken into captivity and he prophesies there. And one of the things he does, he becomes a young intern in the Babylonian government, gets promoted to higher and higher levels of authority in the Babylonian government because of his good behavior and his skill and his wisdom, and God is with him. And Daniel goes in to interpret the dream of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar dreams a dream. Don't have time to talk about the whole thing. But he dreams about an image, and the image has these four components to it, made of these four metals, the gold, silver, bronze, and iron, and the feet of iron and clay. And Daniel tells him this represents four great kingdoms that are going to come before the time when God builds a kingdom that could never be destroyed. But these kingdoms were all going to rise and fall before God's kingdom would be established. Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold, the Babylonian kingdom. But after him, another kingdom would come, and that would be the Persians. And then following them, the Greeks would come. And then following them, the Romans would come. In the days of those kings, Daniel 2 and verse 44, in the days of those kings, the God of heaven would establish a kingdom that would never be destroyed. So Daniel sees the coming of these kingdoms. The unfolding of these kingdoms is a key part of God's plan for history. He wants these kingdoms to unfold because he has a plan. And he has a plan for bringing the Messiah and his kingdom into the world, which will be the ultimate kingdom, where you have this kingdom that can include all nations and all peoples, and they can't be destroyed. These kingdoms all get destroyed. But God's going to build a great empire, a great kingdom, made up of all peoples and tribes and tongues and languages and everything else that cannot be destroyed. God's going to do what these men all wanted to do and did temporarily, but couldn't do in a perfect way or on a permanent basis. These kingdoms rise and fall. The kingdom of the Messiah will not fall. It will last forever. Also during the Babylonian captivity of the Jewish people, something else is happening over on the horizon, perhaps unbeknownst to the Babylonians, or at least they didn't take great notice of it because it didn't seem very important at the time. And that is, the small group of people called the Persians are rising, and they're on the move. And in 550 BC, they conquer another group of people called the Medes, and the two of them join forces and begin building a great kingdom themselves. And they begin growing and growing and taking over more and more. And eventually, in 539 BC, the Persians, the Medes and Persians, have joined forces, and they now conquer the Babylonians. And this happens in the famous handwriting on the wall incident in Daniel chapter 5, where Daniel is still around. By this time, he's fairly old. He has now survived all the way through the Babylonian captivity. He started out as a teenager. Now he's probably in his 80s, perhaps. And at this point, the handwriting on the wall in Daniel chapter 5, perhaps you know the story. I don't have time to read it. But in the story, the handwriting's on the wall. A mysterious hand starts writing during this great feast of Belshazzar, the last king of Babylon. And the handwriting writes out the words, Mene, Mene, Tekel, and Upharsin, or Perez. They're both conjugations of the same word. And the interpretation, Mene, God has numbered your kingdom, Daniel 5:26, and finished it. Tekel, you've been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and Persians. And then verse 30, that very night, Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, that's the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. The letters that were written on the wall, of course, were not Latin or English letters. They were Hebrew letters or Aramaic letters, depending on who's writing and what letters they were. But in any case, the letters that were written on the wall for the last word were P-R-S. They didn't write the vowels. And that creates this very interesting pun, because P-R-S can be written as P-E-R-E-S, which means divided, but it can also be written as P-A-R-A-S, which means Persians. It's a pun. Get it? Kaboomch. Okay, it's a pun. Daniel, there are lots of puns in the Bible, and some of them don't survive the translation. This one you have to go back and look at it. And, oh yeah, hey, that's cute. It divided and given to the Persians, Perez and given to Paraz. Okay, it's a pun. The word Pharisee also comes from this same root word. Okay, and you can kind of see it now that you know what the word is, you can kind of see, oh yeah, Pharisee sounds a lot like that too. And that's because the word Pharisee means separated ones. That's how they, I don't know if that word, if they used that word, if that's what other people called them, but separate, they viewed themselves as separated from the rest of society. They were more holy than everybody else. Everybody else were sinners. They were separated from the sinners. So they viewed themselves as Perez, as Pharisees, as separated ones. So they were divided from everybody else. See, they're not like everybody. Okay. And then this guy receives the kingdom and takes it away from the Babylonians. The Persians have now conquered Babylon. They now own the empire. They now own the kingdom. Well, Cyrus, who is to the Persians, Cyrus the Great. He is the great king of Persia. He is the one who is going out and winning many of these battles. He is the founder of, he is to the Persians what George Washington is to this country, what Caesar Augustus was to the Roman Empire, what Alexander the Great was to the Greeks. Cyrus was to the Persians. And Cyrus is the great leader who has built the great Persian Empire. And upon doing so, he can now begin repatriating, that is, sending back those who find themselves dispersed throughout his kingdom that the Babylonians sent there. So Cyrus benefited from earlier deportations, as Mr. Vanderspeck says, and could even permit himself a policy of repatriation. Things were under control. Cyrus says, well, things are good. I can send these people back. And he may have viewed it politically as, hey, I can keep them under control by making them happy and sending them back to where they want to be. So he issues the order that you read about in Ezra chapter 1 that says, hey, Jewish people, if you want to go back and build your temple, go back and build it. Who is among you? Ezra chapter 1, verse 3. Who is among you of all his people? May his God be with him and let him go up to Jerusalem. So the Jewish people now, after the 70 years of captivity, are now allowed to go back and rebuild. They can rebuild Jerusalem and they can build that temple and get things back right with God again after the captivity. It's now over. So, 536 B.C., some Jews begin to return to Jerusalem under the leadership of Zerubbabel, who, as Ken pointed out, would have been a king if they'd been allowed to have one. But he couldn't because the Persians won't allow somebody else, won't allow the Jews to have a king. They're still, the Jews are still under the dominion of the Persian Empire. We read about that in Nehemiah chapter 9. They're just moving from one part of the Persian Empire to another. They're not declaring independence. They're not making Israel a great kingdom again. They're just a little group of people going back, moving from one part of Persia to another. And so when they get back, of course, they have opposition from the local Samaritans, who are the descendants of other people that were brought in. Remember, the Babylonians are moving people around. And the local Samaritans don't like to see these people coming back. Their population is small. We talked about that in the Bible class this morning. Jerusalem is mostly empty. The city has not fully been rebuilt. A lot of the places are just desolate. And rebuilding is slow. It takes generations to get things rebuilt again. The people are poor. And as they complain in Nehemiah chapter 9, a lot of their money is going back to Persia to enrich the Persian kings. So their tax money is being taken away from them. So they do not have the strong, powerful, independent kingdom like they did in the days of David and Solomon that they wish they could have had. But at least they're rebuilding, and they're trying. Now, we get into this, and again, this came up in the Bible class this morning. See that giant yellow question mark over there? That's because a lot of the dates and so on are not certain. There's confusion among the scholars and experts about the dates. So I put that question mark there to tell you that you may, again, you may see different dates. You may see different, there's problems with the chronologies as far as different historians. Well, which king was this? The Persian kings have different names. One scholar will call the king one thing, and a different history book will call him another name. And then one ancient record will call him one name, and then you read in the Bible and it's a different name. So there's a lot of confusion. And so, again, if you read somebody's history book and it's different from mine, that's okay. We're just trying to figure this out and do the best we can. There's some general things we can conclude. Some of the details are a bit fuzzy, but that's okay. The point I want to make down here is we're talking about the time frame between 500 to 430 B.C. And during that time period, we know for sure that some things happened. Okay, the exact dates may not be sure, but we know that some things happened during that time period. One is that Ezra comes back. Okay, the people have already come back, and some people have come back in 536 B.C. under Zerubbabel. But more time passes, and now more people are trickling back under Ezra. He comes back and teaches the law. And then Nehemiah comes back, and he starts rebuilding the walls. Again, step by step. It's not everybody who just all comes back at once. And a big point here to make, and I have this on the map, you'll notice, is that most of them never come back at all. Some Jews return to Israel at various times, and I notice the word return there is in quotes because most of them aren't returning. They've never been there before. Their fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers had lived in Israel, but they never did. For them to return to Israel will be like we mentioned in class, will be like me returning to Wales, okay, because my great-great-great-grandfather came from Wales, okay. Well, that's nice, but I've never been there, so it's not really returning, even though perhaps I have a Welsh name and my ancestors came from there, but I've never been there, but I'm going back, and that's what these people are doing. They're going back because they know they have a mission, and they know that that's where they need to be. But yet, at the same time, most never do. And even people whose names we know in the Bible, people like Daniel and Esther and Mordecai, they didn't go back. They stayed over there in Persia and did not come back to Israel. All right. I already talked about the chronological problem. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. There's confusion about the names and the kings and so on. Let's move on. Here's an example. There's a list of all the Persian kings. I know you can perfectly read that from the back row. The names, I'm not going to bore you by reading off the names. There won't be a test later. The point is, if you look down those names, Cyrus, Cambyses, Smerdis, Darius I, Xerxes, Artaxerxes, and so on, there's four of them named Artaxerxes, two of them named Xerxes, three of them named Darius, and probably some others named Darius that aren't on the list. What's the point? The point is, you open the Bible and you read in Daniel 5:31, Darius the Mede received the kingdom being 62 years old. He's not on the list. He isn't one of the Persian kings that's on the list. That name is not there at that time period. There's another Darius later on, but that's not him. And so you have to figure out, well, who is this guy that's receiving the kingdom? There's two different theories. Well, one is, he's really this guy named Gubaru, who was a governor that Cyrus appointed, or it's just another name for Cyrus himself. I don't know. But anyway, the point is, Cyrus the Great is the George Washington of the Persian Empire. He's the guy who founds it all. And it's during his time period that Babylon is conquered, and he then issues the decree that the Jews may go back. All right? That's the most important thing you have to understand. He's the key to it all. From then on, you have these characters of Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, the prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. They all happen during the time of the Persian Empire and during the time when the Persians are controlling the fate of the Jewish people. Well, let me rephrase that. God is controlling the fate of the Jewish people, and he's using the Persians to do it. You also have Esther who comes along. Esther and Nehemiah are down here. Nehemiah chapter 2 says that what he was doing, and it came to pass the month of Nisan in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes. Well, that sounds a lot like that where that pink arrow is pointing to, 464 BC to 424 BC. Artaxerxes Longimanus, Artaxerxes I. And it's possible that that is who Esther was married to. You recall that Esther was a Jewish girl in Persia, and the king fires his, the queen gets mad at her, fires her, demotes her, whatever you want to call it, and holds a beauty contest to replace her. And Esther wins the contest. She gets married to the king, forgets to tell him that she's Jewish, and then lots of events happen. She's able to save the people from persecution. Well, it's possible that she was married to this king, the same one that Nehemiah is talking to, around 444, 450s BC time frame. It's also possible that she was married to the one before that. And different scholars have different opinions about that. So I don't know what the right answer is. But she either was married to the king before Nehemiah or the one that Nehemiah talked to, one or the other. And it's hard to figure out. So just to put that into the time frame so you know where that fits in. So there's more of the timeline. We have the temple being rebuilt in 516 BC. Temple rebuilt finally because there was opposition, there was delay, there was slacking off. But the prophets Haggai and Zechariah come along in 516 BC and tell them to get motivated, get busy, finish the temple, which they do. Later on, you have these kings, Xerxes I and then Artaxerxes I. Esther was married to probably one of them, but which one, we're not sure. And then during the time of Artaxerxes, Ezra and Nehemiah both come back and the prophet Malachi is active. And then, what happens? Well, there are no prophets until the time of Christ. That's where the Old Testament writings end. And it doesn't mean nothing was happening. It just means that God didn't send him any more prophets. And so they had to get along with what had already been written and try to follow it as best they could. There were no prophets. And down through the next century, the next century passes, and then you get down to the bottom of the timeline. In 331 BC, the Greeks, under Alexander the Great, conquer Persia. And now the Greeks are in control of God's people. And a lot of things will happen there, but that's outside the scope of this lesson. It's real interesting, though. The Greeks come along in 330 BC and conquer Persia, and Daniel predicted this in Daniel chapter 10. And what's interesting about Daniel 10 is, in Daniel 10, Daniel predicts this, and he says, where this angel or this miraculous figure, whatever he is, one having the likeness of a man, touched me and strengthened me, in verse 20. Then he said, "Do you know why I've come to you? And now I must return to fight with the prince of Persia. When I've gone forth, indeed, the prince of Greece will come." So here Daniel is predicting, and Daniel is kind of lifting the curtain and showing you what's going on behind the scenes in the councils of heaven with this angel or this messenger from God, telling him that God is working behind the scenes to bring down the Persians and bring in the Greeks. And they're going to replace the Persians in control of this great empire. And it's an interesting picture because you don't always see this. You see world history, you can read a history book and see, well, this happened, and this general, and this king, and so on. What you don't see in the history book is an angel or God behind the scene making sure that this king wins this battle, or that this weather hits and this army gets stuck in the mud, and so they can't get up to the appropriate time, and they lose this war. All kinds of little events like that that are happening behind the scenes, as we might call it in a providential way, because Alexander didn't perform miracles to win his battles, but yet he was always in the right place at the right time with the right people and the right number of troops and the right strategy, and he won these battles. But why did Alexander the Great win these battles and defeat Persia? Because God made sure that it happened, and God was working behind the scenes to make it happen for his own reasons and his purpose. All right, what was its impact on Bible history? Well, one was, when the Persians came along, they returned the Jewish people out of captivity, which meant that the Jews who wanted to go back were able to keep alive the Messianic hope. They knew that they had to keep alive the concept and the existence of a nation of Israel so that the Messiah could come. The Messiah cannot come in Babylon. The Messiah cannot come in Persia. The Messiah has to come from Israel. So there has to be an Israel for him to come. So they have to go back and reconstitute the nation of Israel so the Messiah can come. They know they've got a role in history to play. They don't fully understand it, but they know it's important. And they come back to do it. Rebuilding the temple and restoring the worship of God. Again, getting it back. We saw that in the Bible class this morning. Restoring and following God's laws more carefully than they had in the past. Not just the temple, but the exact letter of the law. What does the law say? Oh, we haven't been doing this all these years. Let's get busy and do it. Let's fix these things. Let's restore the worship and the everyday practice and all the things that are in that law. Let's start doing them like we're supposed to. And you know what? That's a lesson for us today, too. We should all be doing that. We should all have that same spirit, that same attitude that the people in Ezra and Nehemiah's time did. It says, all right, even if people haven't been doing a lot of this stuff, and we look through the New Testament, and we say, well, this isn't how people worship today. Well, let's do it. Let's do it the way they did it in the Bible. And that was how Ezra and Nehemiah were able to get the people of God back into a good relationship with God, was by just going back to his word and say, what does it say? Let's just follow it carefully like we should have been all this time. And let's ask God to help us. Another key thing that came out of the Persian Empire was the enforcing of the ban on intermarriage that preserved the Jewish nation. You see that, again, in Ezra and Nehemiah. The people got serious about separating the Jewish people. Well, not just, hey, let's just mix in with anybody, whoever. No, we're going to follow what the law says and maintain this separate identity so that we don't mix in with all the other nations of people, and we can maintain that pure nation of people that are dedicated to God. And it also shows the providential working of God. I talked about that. That God's plan has not been defeated, even though it appeared to be. Even though God's kingdom had apparently been destroyed, but yet God saved the remnant and brought them back, and they were able to reconstitute and keep God's plan alive and not let it be destroyed. Not let Satan win that ultimate victory that it appeared he had won when Jerusalem was destroyed in 586 BC. Now, there's no miracles in Ezra and Nehemiah and Esther. There's a couple of prophets who come along. You know what the prophets tell them? Zechariah has some prophecies about the Messiah, but most of what Haggai and Malachi tell him, you know what you tell him? Just do the stuff you're supposed to be doing. That's kind of what those prophets did. How about get busy and do what you're supposed to be doing? They didn't teach him a lot of new stuff that's, oh, we didn't know about that. Didn't know. No, just do the stuff you're supposed to be doing. And there's no miracles. They didn't part the Red Sea. They don't cast out demons. They don't make manna appear. All that miraculous stuff that you read about in other parts of the Old Testament, that's not what these guys do. That's not what Ezra and Nehemiah did. They just led the people in every day, let's just keep God's laws. Let's just get right with God. And that's the point I want to make here. And this is the conclusion. Go ahead and open your songbook to the song that was chosen. And let me reach my conclusion here. My conclusion is, based on Ezra chapter 8, where Ezra is going back, he's getting ready to lead some people back and teach the law when he gets back. He says, I was ashamed to request of the king, that's the Persian king, an escort of soldiers and horsemen to help us against the enemy on the road, because we had spoken to the king saying, the hand of our God is upon all those for good who seek him, but his power and his wrath are against all those who forsake him. So we fasted and entreated our God for this, and he answered our prayer. Verse 31, and we departed from the river of Ahava on the 12th day of the first month to go to Jerusalem, and the hand of our God was upon us, and he delivered us from the hand of the enemy and from ambush along the road. There's no miracle going along here. What's happening is a lot of fasting and prayer. And that's how Ezra and Nehemiah and the people of that day served God. You know what? That's how we serve Him. I'm not expecting any miracle to come down from heaven and fix our problems. But what I do expect is that through prayer and, yes, fasting if necessary, but by serving God, seeking His Word carefully and praying about it, God can solve the problems we have. He can overcome the barriers that we face, and He can deal with whatever challenges and risks and threats that may discourage us. And I encourage you to have that same spirit and that same heart.